Hi, welcome to this week's program. As part of my Live Well series, I wanted to address the financial implications of having children, or more specifically, having your first child. While becoming a parent is very exciting and fulfilling, it's also significantly life-changing in many ways. So here, let me focus on the financial aspects of becoming a parent. Well, if you're a two-income couple, one of the first changes you might face is a straight reduction in your wife's income should she go on short-term or extended maternity leave. So the many young, expecting couples are faced with a sudden loss of income of the mother. So make sure, as soon as you find out you're going to become parents, that you use the remaining 7 or 8 months before the baby's birth to set your finances in order and rejig your lifestyle to accommodate a new person in your household and a drop in take-home pay. In instances where the mother is not working, adjust your lifestyle for the added expenses of the newborn, too. And ideally, if you can, plan ahead as soon as you're married or in a relationship where the two of you would want children. Also, if you're employed by a larger company, speak to your employer to see if you're covered by short-term disability insurance that could pay you up to 70% of your gross income for about 6 weeks, typically. Also, check with HR on the maternity benefits and make full use of them on things like your insurance copays that treat a pregnancy like any other medical condition and plan ahead for necessary out-of-pocket expenses. All right, so in addition to loss of income, a baby comes with multiple expenses, such as added healthcare deduction from your salary, out-of-pocket hospital expenses for the mother and child, temporary periods of absence for the father that could also result in reduced pay close to the time of delivery, and of course, money for the baby's clothes, the toys, the crib, the formula, the diapers, and so on and so on. You're sort of hit by a mini tsunami of expenses when a baby is born, so it's best that you be as prepared as possible. Now, a lot of excited parents tend to get carried away and buy expensive cribs, expensive clothes, and so on. You know, driven by a noble thought where they want to give their child the best they can afford. But frankly, the child knows no better. A $1 toy from the dollar store is often as exciting and challenging as a $50 gift from your favorite baby store. My dad used to say the best toy for a child was a jar with some pennies. Put the pennies in the jar, he'd take them out of the jar. And that would satisfy his time for hours, he would say. So really, it isn't the price of the toy that you pay for. It's really whether the toy itself is fascinating the child. Also, a fancy crib made of solid wood can easily be substituted by something that's way less expensive and allow you to focus on the basics and then some. You know, give your child a comfortable mattress and a warm blanket, and you'll be fine. This is also a good time to look for used items. You know, you can get excellent quality children's items that other kids have simply outgrown, and they're going for a song. Similarly, use events such as the baby shower to ask for practical and inexpensive gifts so you can get 2 or 3 really useful things in place of items that the baby's really indifferent to. And in doing so, that helps to reduce your expenses by getting those necessary and basic items. Of course, we all want our kids to look cute and all, so go ahead and buy a few pretty clothes, but stick to thriftier stores if you can. They too have plenty of good options that will not reduce your baby's cute quotient. Instead, invest in things that matter, such as good quality diapers, good quality and healthy baby food and formula, a good car seat. I always say, buy great socks. And what I mean is, it's wise to pay up for something that will last a long time and give you pleasure with its use. Kids outgrow clothes pretty quickly, so I don't think paying up for a whole wardrobe is a great idea. An item or two, sure, but you can save money by paring back on the rest. Now, looking way ahead, as soon as you have a baby, you can also start socking away for the baby's education. There are tax-free contributions to the Coverdell Education Savings Account. There's tuition programs like the 529 plans that let you invest today so the money grows tax-free. As I've repeatedly said, use the power of compounding. By starting with small but regular contributions, invest this money in higher-yielding securities like stocks at first, then gradually shift the allocation to bonds or CDs as your child reaches an age where the funds need to be withdrawn. You'll be amazed at how effective these plans are in reducing future education-related expenses. Maybe suggest these to your parents and grandparents as a way they can help if they're so inclined. And finally, don't ignore your own retirement. And through it all, make sure you don't also ignore the contributions that you have to make for yourself. If circumstances or financial constraints make money tight, reduce your contributions down to $100 or even $50 a month, but keep the continuity and the discipline and actively streamline your lifestyle preferences to your new circumstances, to the point where you still manage to save enough for retirement. See, if your household income drops from $100,000 to $50,000 suddenly, it may seem like there's no way you can save. But I've come across enough individuals who make less than $50,000 a year, have children, yet manage to steadily build their financial nest eggs. It may seem hard at first, but if you have the will to save, you will find a way. And after all, the reason for all of this is to have the most control of your life as possible. And since we only have one chance at this life, having wealth gives you the freedom and the flexibility to have your one best financial life.
Slumber, my darling, thy mother is near, guarding thy dreams from all terror and fear. Sunlight has passed, and the twilight has gone.
You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Stacy Rappacon is an online editor for Kiplinger.com, and she is here with me to discuss not what colleges are best, because that's the subject of many articles, but what majors are best. Hey, Stacy, welcome to the show.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
So what did Kiplinger find about this? What are the best majors? We're going to actually go down most of the list, and I will post this on my website, stevepomerantz.com, but let's get started.
Well, just to start off, we found that it really makes a big difference what you major in. Everybody knows now that getting a college degree is very important, but there is a huge difference between majors and what your lifetime earnings is. The best majors or the highest earning majors can earn up to $3.4 million more over their lifetime than the lowest paying majors. So it's really important to consider these things before you choose your major. Obviously, on our best list, no surprise that a lot of engineering and tech fields and business fields wound up here. So here at number 10, we have finance is among our top majors.
Starting salary is about what?
It's about $53,300, mm-hmm. and that's compared to a median for all majors of around $43,000.
Okay.
So it's a pretty good start to your career.
Yeah. And then over time, your earnings build. So in terms of mid-career salary, what are some of the expectations?
Right. Yeah. Once you're in the field for about 10 years, you can expect to get the median to go up to over $93,000 a year.
Yeah, which is above the median for all majors. So again, if you start high, you're going to end up higher. And I think that's probably one of the lessons for everybody to get from this. So finance, what's next?
Next, we have actuarial mathematics. Obviously, that would ultimately often lead to the position of actuary, which is a very in-demand job.
Okay.
Again, you're starting off pretty high at $56,400 a year with your starting salary. That's the median for employees who have worked 5 years or less.
Mm-hmm.
Then once you get up to mid-career, you're over $100,000. You're at $131,700 a year.
Oh, yeah. So that's pretty good. So that's a career that insurance companies hire for and other statistical analysis type of companies. And that's going to be a growing field as big data takes over and they're going to need people to crunch those numbers.
Right, exactly.
All right. On this countdown from the best, we started with 10, we were at 9. Number 8 is what?
Number 8 is physics. Again, a nice starting salary around $58,000 a year, and the mid-career salary goes up to over $100,000 a year.
Mm-hmm. Seeing a lot of math here in these first. So for those people who are math challenged, we're going to have to go down the list and see what else may work for them. But the starting salary for physics is $58,000. Mid-career salary is $108,000. And I like as well that you post the number of online job postings, or you list them. And for physics, it's $115,000. For actuarial mathematics, it was $25,000.
Mm-hmm.
But for finance, it was $1.4 million. Lots of jobs out there. Lots of people looking for jobs. Number seven on our list of the top 10 majors for college.
Yeah, seven is a very popular one, business administration. Mm-hmm. It's a great field to get into. And yeah, these college majors do very well for themselves.
Yeah, so I guess you'll need some math there, but it's not nearly the kind that you need when you're when you're going for a job in physics. So, okay, well, that makes sense. So the mid-career salary is about $77,000. There are 3.7 million online job postings for people who are getting a degree in business administration. Number six, what is that?
Number six, we have management information systems. And this is in the hot tech field. It's a computer, or it leads into a computer job. And obviously, that's going to be doing very well for the future.
Mm-hmm. And what exactly is that? That's so managing information systems, managing computers and systems and the like in that area, right?
Right. So you could be working for a company to implement the network that they're using, implement the technology.
Okay.
So you might be working with their email system, working on their servers and developing the technology that runs basically every company now.
Right. Computer science is next. Starting salary of $65,000, mid-career salary of $110,000. I think we all know what that is. Kind of could be software developer as well.
Mm-hmm.
2 million online job postings. Then we get to mechanical engineering. I have to go through these kind of fast. Starting salary, $64,000, which is very nice. Mid-career salary, $106,000. Only 241,000 online job postings. So that kind of sends a message. What is number three, Stacy?
Number three, we have civil engineering. So yeah, at the top of the list, we've got a bunch of engineering fields.
Mm-hmm.
And this engineering field, you know, in terms of construction and building, so obviously there's going to be a lot of demand for that.
Especially after our recent hurricanes.
Right.
Yeah, spending on infrastructure as well and all the things that need to be done in this country.
Right.
Biomedical engineering is the number two here. Starting salary of about $63,000, mid-career salary of $103,000, 51,000 online job postings, biomedical engineering. And then down to number one here is what?
Number one is nursing. I think that's no big surprise mm-hmm. there. Nursing is a popular field and is a very high demand job.
So the starting salary is $58,000, mid-career salary $76,000, 1.9 million online job postings. So those are the top 10. I've kind of gone through them quickly because we will list them on our website, but I wanted to get into the 10 worst college majors for a lucrative career. What is number 10 for the worst?
Number 10, we have religious studies.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, we were looking at the same criteria. So we're looking at starting salary, mid-career salary, annual online job postings. Religious studies, the starting salary was below $40,000. Again, the median is $43,250 a year.
Mm-hmm.
So this was at $38,300. And a mid-career only gets up to $62,100.
Yeah, well,
below the median of $74,000, $75,000, really.
Yeah, I think if you get into religious studies, though, you probably have another calling other than money. But money is important
right.
anyway, right? All right, next, exercise science. What is that?
Exercise science is actually, it's a good field because it leads to eventually you might become a physical therapist.
Mm.
But once you major that, then you have to go on to more extensive education. You have to get your doctorate or your license to become a physical therapist.
Right.
So you're studying fitness and how the body works and exercise. It's an interesting field. And if you love sports, it's a good one to go into.
But not as lucrative. Yeah.
Yeah, if you just go with the bachelor's degree in that field, you end up with a starting salary. Most people will end up with a starting salary around $36,000 a year, and mid-career will only get up to $54,500 a year.
Right. And then the next two are not surprising, though I think unfortunate. first one is music,
mm-hmm.
and the second one is art history. So the starting salary in music is $38,200, which is below the median. Mid-career salary, $63,000. And I think the key here is that for every winner on The Voice, there are thousands and thousands of people auditioning each year who you've never heard of. So the rest of them have to find some work in the industry. And I guess it's teaching or putting together, like, you know, gigging, you know, playing and teaching and putting together as much as you can.
Right. Yeah. Unfortunately, there are a lot of art majors, art fields on this list. Again, I mean, as I say in the article, these majors, you can get a good job out of these fields, but you don't necessarily have to go to college in order to do them.
Yeah.
You know, college is a huge investment, and it's so important to think about what you're going to be studying while you're spending all that money, borrowing all that money to go to college.
Absolutely.
So, you know, music, you can definitely still do it. We're not trying to discourage people to study these things. I think it's worthwhile personally, but unfortunately, this is the way the dollars work out.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think if you go to a specialized college for music or for art, you know, there may be something there. But if you've got some talent, you know, find a mentor and study, because spending, what, $100,000, $150,000 on education is going to put you behind the eight ball.
Right.
And be very difficult for you to dig out.
And then with these fields also, to get into the bigger jobs with music and art history, you do have to go on to get additional degrees, advanced degrees in these fields too. So it ends up even costing even more to get into them.
Well, number three on the list is something that I'm a little familiar with because it's radio and television. I'm glad I don't do radio for my primary source of income. Starting salary is $38,000. Mid-career salary is $64,000. So it might seem glamorous and a lot of fun, and it is to some degree both of those, but it doesn't really pay all that much.
Yeah, and I thought it interesting that not a lot of people who go on to become radio or television announcers even majored in radio and television. A lot of them majored in communications, journalism, or broadcasting, and you know that also opened them up to go after other fields if they decided to go in a slightly different direction later in their careers.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, but I do want to mention, I guess I hate to say it this way, but the worst major on the list was photography. So moms and dads, be warned if your child wants a degree in photography. Not that there's anything wrong with it, but it pays the least of all of them. I want to hear this interview again, want to get to this list yourself, and also all the other informative interviews, and get them straight into your inbox. Subscribe to our weekly update at stevepomerantz.com. Stacy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
A recession is inevitable. We know that, especially now with tariffs, the trade war, and the possibility of a looming war in the Middle East. So, do you wonder how it will affect your financial security when it eventually comes? This is exactly what I'll be speaking to you about at my next workshop. I'll show you how to calculate whether you'll be financially secure for the rest of your life, and how to make the right decisions to get financially secure and stay there. We'll talk about where to get the income you need, especially in this low interest rate world, and I'll also talk about how to get an early read on the next recession and ways to make sure your portfolio is properly positioned. These are just a few of the topics I'll be discussing, and of course, as always, I'm there to answer any of your questions. So, join me Tuesday, October 15th at 10 a.m. at the Boca Raton Renaissance Hotel. That's Tuesday, October 15th at the Boca Raton Renaissance Hotel. Go to stevepomerantz.com to sign up. That's stevepomerantz.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. Jonathan Clements is the founder and editor of Humble Dollar. He's also the author of a fistful of personal finance books, including From Here to Financial Happiness and How to Think About Money. Now, Jonathan also spent almost 20 years at the Wall Street Journal, where he was the newspaper's personal finance columnist. I always enjoy talking with him and sharing our knowledge and experiences together. And here he is with me on the line. Jonathan, welcome once again.
Steve, thanks so much for having me on.
My pleasure. So I was reading through your articles, trying to figure out what to talk about this time. And I saw some little throwaway that you put out there on Labor Day. And it was what you call the 11 great unanswered financial questions. And, you know, I thought we'd have some fun with that in a nerdy kind of way. You know, this is questions about finance, kind of nerdy. But I don't know that we'll have the answers to these, but I thought we would give it a shot. What do you think?
Let's go for it.
Okay, good. All right, here we go. Number one, who does more financial damage, stockbrokers or life insurance agents? Oh my God, what a question.
And of course, what we're getting at here is both stockbrokers and life insurance agents, the thing they have in common is they both work on commission.
That's exactly what I wrote in my notes. That's it.
And so they have an incentive not only to sell you the investment products that have the highest commissions, but also they have an incentive to get you to act frequently so that you generate even more commissions.
All right, let's be fair and say that there are, I'm sure, many people who have these conditions of earning commissions who do the right thing as much as they can. I think what we're trying to say here is that there is, human nature being what it is, some possibility of abuse. And part of the problem is the investor, the client, doesn't always know what they're paying.
So let's just give an example of how this financial incentive tilts the odds. So if you look at the statistics on life insurance and you talk to most sort of unbiased financial observers, they'll say that for the vast majority of Americans, the best bet is term life insurance, which is, you know, you have a low annual premium, you have it for the time it takes to raise the kids and get them through college, and then you drop the policy. As it turns out, 60% of the life insurance policies that are sold every year are cash value life insurance.
Yes.
And why do you think that is, Steve?
Well, because the commissions for those policies are really horrendously high.
And faced with the possibility of a high commission, guess what life insurance agents sell?
Yeah.
Cash value life insurance.
Cash value life insurance. Which brings me to another question. Question number four. Should you dump that wretched cash value life insurance policy you were persuaded to buy 7 years ago, or hang on and hope you'll die young so you turn a profit?
And this is a tough one because more than anything else, it's an emotional question. You know, if you've been paying those huge premiums for cash value life insurance for 7 years, you have what economists call a sunk cost. You know, you really don't want to walk away from all those premiums that you've paid, even though after that 7 years of premium payments, the amount of cash value that you've accumulated is probably not a huge amount.
Well, I don't think you necessarily get even with your premiums that you've put in. I think it normally takes about 10 years before you've made up the commissions. Of course, there is the cost of insurance in there too, but till the cash value equals the premiums that you've put in, 10 years.
So maybe I should have changed the question to 10 years rather than 7.
No, I think 7 is feels, you know, you get the 7-year itch. You know, I've been paying this thing for 7 years. The cash value is only 80% of the amount that I've actually put in, if it's that much. And should I dump this thing? And, you know, it is cynical to say, do I have to die young in order to make a return on this investment? So I'm not going to let you off the hook too much. That was a little cynical, Jonathan.
Really? Just a little?
All right. All right. Okay. So let's go to the next question here. Is taking Social Security early and then assuming you'll make double-digit gains by investing the money a brilliant strategy or utterly delusional?
So there are two parts to this, right? One is whether you can indeed earn double-digit gains. And, you know, history tells us that you can do that by investing in the stock market. At least that's been the case in the past. Whether it's going to be true in the future, we don't know. But that isn't a crazy assumption. But we then have this issue that when you compare investing in the stock market to Social Security, you're really comparing apples to oranges, because Social Security is more like a bond, right? It's government guaranteed. You get the same amount every year. In fact, it increases along with inflation. So it's a very reliable, predictable stream of income. Investing in the stock market, strange to relate, is not quite so predictable.
Is that true? I've never heard that before.
Really?
Yeah.
No, it's a rumor out there these things go up and down.
All right. So here's another thing too. When you're at the age to take Social Security, are you really going to take all that money, 100% of that money, and throw it into stocks, number one? Number two, do you have the kind of emotional, behavioral makeup to put up with the uncertainty and the volatility and to actually do the right thing when things are at their greatest point of stress?
And the answer to that is there is 0.1% of the population that may be able to do that.
Yes.
For the other 99.9, unless they're one of your clients, Steve, I don't think they're going to be able to do it.
Well, you know, I think there are reasons to take Social Security early, but taking the money and investing it in the stock market looking for double-digit returns, I don't think is one of them.
I would agree.
Okay. All right. Number three, four, five, whatever we're at. Is a home the best investment you'll ever make, or a money-sucking pile of bricks?
And I would answer, it is both. So anybody who's ever owned a home knows that houses eat money.
Yes.
They have a voracious appetite.
Yes.
It is indeed, you know, a hole in the ground into which you pour your excess cash. On the other hand, homes can be a great long-run investment, but not for the reason that people think. It's not that you're going to make a whole lot of money from the price appreciation. Instead, the value in owning a home is the fact that you get to live there and you get to enjoy the house's what's called imputed rent. The fact that you get to live there without having to send a check off to the landlord every month. Mm-hmm. That is the value in owning a home. It's not the price appreciation.
All right, let me add my two cents. So when you talk about the cost of maintaining your home, that's coming out of current income mostly. The house itself, as you're paying this rent or this mortgage, you're slowly paying down the principal. So in a sense, your income is handling the maintenance, but your principal is building up over time. And then you've got this nest egg that has been created because of all the savings, the appreciation of the home, which is not that great, but nevertheless, maybe inflation, you're appreciating by the rate of inflation, but you've paid down the mortgage. So it's, in a sense, it's that forced savings idea. But again, the maintenance is coming out of current income. So a lot of people, matter of fact, I just interviewed somebody who's 95 years old. He said he sold his house, and it was the sale of that house that allowed him to move into an assisted living facility.
So here in the New York area, which is where I live, we have a one word to describe our retirement strategy. And that strategy is called Florida. So you spend your entire working career struggling to buy a New York area piece of real estate.
Okay.
And when you finally pay off that mortgage, what you do is you trade down to some much less expensive place in Florida, free up a bunch of capital, and live off it for the rest of your life.
Okay. That's arbitrage. That's what the term means. You're arbitraging cost of living, right?
I think Florida is a much better term for it.
Okay. All right. So let's move on here. Are everyday investors as stupid as Wall Street claims, or are folks on Wall Street just rude and cravenly self-serving?
And so I would argue that investors may be foolish, they may be, but they actually are protected by something called market efficiency. We know that the markets are highly efficient, meaning that stocks and bonds, most of the time, are priced at about the level they should be. And so that means that even if you don't know anything and you go out and you buy a stock mutual fund or you buy a bond mutual fund, you're probably getting a fair price. So there is indeed a serious chance that many investors are foolish, but it doesn't mean that they end up acting foolishly.
Okay, that's quite interesting. There are those statistics which show that the average investor, because they invest incorrectly, they trade too much, they invest in things that they believe are going to somehow beat the market, that the rate of return that they earn is significantly less than what the markets offer if you just kind of leave it alone. You think that fits into this question?
No, absolutely. So even if investors do not buy investments that are overpriced on a regular basis, even if we say that's the case, and I believe that is indeed true, ignorant investors run two risks. One, they trade too much, which means they incur excessive investment costs.
Right.
And two, they don't diversify, which means they make big bets on just a couple of different stocks or on just a few bonds. And because of that, they run the risk of blowing themselves up if any of those stocks or bonds turn out to be bad investments. But it's the costs and the excess risk-taking that's the problem. It's not that they are buying these investments at the wrong price.
Yeah. We are out of time, Jonathan. My guest, Jonathan Clements, founder of and editor of Humble Dollar. People get to your website how, Jonathan?
Well, there's this thing called the internet, Steve, and you put in the you put in humbledollar.com and then you hit the return button and you should end up there.
So I'm gonna make a 12th question. Is Jonathan Clements a wise guy or what? Okay, that's the next question. But you don't have to answer that because we're out of time. But I do want to say humbledollar.com, and you got a lot of personal finance books. They're all great. All this experience at the Wall Street Journal, which is where I read you for many, many years. And thank you for coming on once again and sharing this time with me.
It was a lot of fun, Steve. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. To hear this in any interview again, if you have a question about what we've just discussed, don't forget to go to our website. That's that thing on the internet that Jonathan was talking about. StevePomeranz.com, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z. Skip the T, go right to the Z. And you can also sign up for our weekly update where we'll have everything that we're doing on the show sent to you in a nice, sweet little package once a week of pictures and audio and transcripts if you like to read it. That's StevePomeranz.com.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
You're listening to the Steve Pomeranz Show. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
I was wondering whether there's been any information about home prices and rising water levels.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people ask me about the rising water level. And to me, I don't think much of it because I don't see it around me, but it's always, you know, what's around you. So, you know, for example, that what they're claiming is that there's been a $15.8 billion in lost home values.
Like reduction in prices.
Correct.
Because,
from 2005 to 2017 because of this. So, for example, the top cities with the biggest value decline, Ocean City, New Jersey, followed by Miami Beach, followed by Hollywood, Florida, and then Charleston, South Carolina, and then St. Petersburg. So there is a real problem. It does exist. It's not.
It's not actually out there in the consciousness yet. It's really hard to see. You need a study to look at the individual statistics to tell what's going on.
Correct. Correct.
Florida has experienced the greatest relative loss of home values: $5.4 billion. New Jersey, $4.5 billion, and New York, $1.3 billion. So maybe it's a problem that's beginning to take hold, and maybe you'll start seeing it more and more.
Right.
All right, I want to ask you a question. This has to do with something that you're very familiar with, because as a realtor, you're dealing with closings all the time.
Right.
There was a question that was posed that someone moved into a community and was provided with a set of the recorded governing documents of that community. And there was no size limit on pet dogs, but this person had a large dog. And now he's received a violation notice indicating that these dogs are not allowed. Apparently, he didn't see the most recent documents, and he wants to know, does he have to follow the current rule because he was given old documents?
It's kind of like, I didn't know that was, you couldn't run the red light, officer.
Yeah.
I didn't read that.
I didn't know I could make a left turn.
You know. From the right lane.
Exactly.
Yeah, so here's the deal.
Yeah.
This is a very common situation. You go to sell a condo, townhome, what have you, the seller provides their agent the condo docs or governing documents. They give them to the other realtor. The realtor gives them to the buyer, and they are old. They haven't seen an amended set in
years.
They're
like on parchment paper.
They're on parchment paper. You know, folks, if you receive something like this, please know that there's probably an updated set. So as a seller, it's highly advisable that you get an updated, fresh set. Why is it so important for you as a seller? Because any time prior to closing, if there's a document that's missing or incorrect, it could be grounds for the buyer walking, you know, from the closing. So you don't want that to happen. And then B, as a buyer, call the association. Make sure you got the most updated set of documents, especially when it comes to pets.
Especially.
Pets and rent rules. Those are the two sticking
and pickup trucks.
And pickup trucks. Oh my gosh, the pickup trucks.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's common sense, but it's something that could be easily overlooked. There's so many other things to pay attention to.
That's right.
During a closing. And that's what a realtor will bring that to your attention. I think that's a good point right there. Okay. So we're looking at an article that says, are property taxes too high? And the answer is yes, but they could be worse. If you think your property taxes are too high, a recent study by WalletHub.com has data to back you up. But it also shows that taxpayers in other states would gladly trade tax bills with you. And we have got some stats here to help support this. Florida is 26th out of 50 states and the District of Columbia when it comes to what's called the effective real property tax rate. So that's kind of the percentage that you pay per dollar value.
We're in the middle.
We're in the middle. Okay. We kind of know that a lot of states have much higher tax rates. For example, you would think that Hawaii would have a higher tax rate, and of course, New Jersey. What else does this say?
Well, what's interesting about those states is they have actually a lower tax rate, but the value of their properties is so much higher. So when you multiply it out, that's why they're paying exorbitantly more in their taxes.
So the effective tax rate for Florida could be 1%.
Yep.
But average house could be $300,000.
Correct.
Right?
Where in Hawaii,
it's a half of 1%. But $800,000 is the price of the house.
It's a starter home.
Yeah, so they actually have some stats here. So with the Florida tax rate, using a house worth $193,500, that's just a kind of a median value in 2017, the Florida tax rate was 0.98%, which results in a bill of $1,897. Hawaii, a property owner in Hawaii, would only get a bill for $525, and someone in New Jersey would pay nine times more, $4,725.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Now, but the median home price in Hawaii is $563,000. So you're going to be paying more than three times the actual tax. So that's really the issue.
Yep.
So prices are not as high as in other areas of the country. Tax rates relative to the price of the home may be higher. The percentage tax, interesting idea there.
Yeah, see, I didn't know we were ranked around, 26 out of the 50 states. So that's kind of exciting. We're in the middle.
Yeah, in the middle.
So we're expensive, but we're not
average.
We're just average.
You don't want to be
average. Average Florida.
All right. You know, I was wondering, with the economy so good, are you seeing any rise in foreclosures?
You know, Steve, I saw one I'm actually almost involved in one. I haven't seen a short sale in a long, long time. And one of my listings...
Well, define a short sale.
So a short sale is when you're upside down. In other words, you owe more than the house is worth.
Okay. So you're going to sell it and you're not going to be able to pay off the mortgage.
Correct.
And that money's going to have to come from somewhere.
From somewhere.
So you're short.
So if you have money, it's going to come out of your pocket.
Yeah.
If you don't have money, then you're going to go to the bank and say, I beg for forgiveness. Please write this off, which I don't know that they're going to do anymore. They did in the heyday. So the bottom line is...
But you still have to pay taxes on that. If the bank does that, you're going to get a surprise.
Correct.
That's right.
So it's kind of like a pre-foreclosure. It's what you see first before it goes to foreclosure. Foreclosures are happening a lot quicker when they drop the gauntlet on you.
At the courthouse, so to speak.
Right, exactly. So I really haven't seen much. This is my first...
So this may go. So it's a race between you and the bank now. If you're trying to sell the property first before the bank takes it over.
Okay. Exactly.
All right. Interesting stuff. My guest, as always, is Terry Story, a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida, and can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve. ¶¶
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. I recently started having the Sun Sentinel delivered daily to my door, and I came across a series of articles addressing the real-life facts about options for older people in later life. So I invited the author of these series of articles to join me and discuss it. He is Mort Maser. He is a 95-year-old freelance writer, and he's addressing the very issues that he's facing himself and his readers are also interested in as well. Mort Maser, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you very much, Steve.
So you've been writing articles, as I said, addressing the challenges faced by older Americans with regards to the high cost of getting old. What are some of the challenges that they're facing?
Well, people have to learn and evaluate the senior housing choices to determine what is best for their specific situation.
Mm-hmm.
For example, there are independent living facilities, assisted living, skilled nursing, memory care, or Alzheimer's care. People should evaluate the cost of each to determine which is best.
All right, we're going to get into those in particular in a minute. But one of the worries, I think, of seniors today is this challenge of whether or not you're going to outlive your assets because you're going to need the money to pay for these necessities, whether you're going to be renting in a senior living facility or buying in. What about the cost of doctors and hospital stays? What kind of financial condition would you say the average person is in their 80s and so on, and how much money they have to devote to the best care they can get?
If a person or a couple is in their 80s, 80% of the people that age bracket do not have enough assets to rent or buy in in a senior facility.
80% seems like a lot.
It's a great deal. It is a lot. People are unprepared for this financial responsibility when they get that age. People should start planning at age 30 for the later years, and very few people do it.
There are challenges as people raise their children and the cost of getting them into college. And then as they get older, their parents may also need a financial assistance. It's been termed the sandwich generation. You're sandwiched in between your kids who you're trying to help and your aging parents as well. Do you see some of that?
Exactly. I had that experience years ago with an aged aunt who I was executor for, and she had no one. She was a single woman, and she had contracted Alzheimer's, and it was a desperate time for her because she had very limited assets. And we worked with her daily, practically, in getting her the proper care. But it's a desperate time for families when a loved one needs help and you're raising your family, you're getting prepared for college education for your children.
Yes.
As you said, it's the sandwich generation.
Let's talk about some of the options available and let's leave the money aside, whether people have enough money or don't have enough money. Let's just talk about the options themselves. So you had mentioned a few of them before. Let's start from the top. I guess independent living would be number one.
I'm going to start from my own experience because we're here at a facility in Boca for the past 5 years.
Okay.
It is an independent living situation for us. However, in addition, they have assisted living facilities, skilled nursing facilities, a separate building for memory care, and another building for Alzheimer's care.
Mm-hmm.
And each of these carries its own expenses that people have to be prepared for, which, in my opinion, they are not.
Yeah. So let's start with independent living. That sounds like having a one or two bedroom apartment where you're cooking your own meals and you're able to do the typical activities of daily living. Is that correct?
Well, here we do not do any cooking, although there is a small kitchen.
Yeah.
We are served two or three meals a day. It depends on the arrangement that was made originally. We have two meals a day, breakfast and dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And the meals are prepared. We have a large dining room, and the food is adequate, and you're cared for in that way. You don't have to worry about cooking anymore.
Now, did you buy in or are you renting? How does that work?
No, this is a rental. We're okay. We're in a rental facility.
Okay.
Our rent for the missus and I is $5,000 a month approximately.
Yes. How much has that increased over the 5 years that you've been there?
Every year we get an increase of between 4 and 5%.
That's pretty significant when you think about it.
Yes, it certainly is.
So how are you, sir? And I don't need to know your personal finances, but you're getting Social Security. You're 95 years old, so it must be a fairly significant amount, relatively speaking. And how are you funding this personally?
Well, not really. The Social Security isn't that much.
Okay.
But I have a pension from my corporate life.
Okay.
And we lived in Delray for 27 years mm-hmm. in two different communities in single-family homes. So the sale price of those two homes have given us a background, a financial background, that has helped us continue here for 5 years.
Would you say that your home was a significant part of your nest egg?
Definitely.
Yeah.
I did not have too many investments to come back on. I did not have the right financial tutoring in my career
yeah.
that enabled me to build a stock or bond nest egg,
yeah.
unfortunately.
Unfortunately, yeah. But on the other hand, you did have a pension.
Yes, I do.
So some organization, your company, was taking money off the table and investing it for you to be able to get your pension. So you did, in essence, have some of that, even though you didn't have your own personal.
Yeah, well, and looking back, you know, hindsight is 20/20.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And looking back, I failed to hook up with a financial planner
yeah.
in my early years. And I think that is a great disservice that I did to my family.
Mm-hmm.
I have an older son, and he has an older son, 70 and 45 respectively. They are using a financial planner in Georgia,
mm-hmm.
and they're very satisfied
yeah.
with what the finances that has been accumulated
yeah. good.
For them. So I recommend yeah. that a great deal.
Well, I, of course, being, you know, one myself, I would totally agree. I know the benefit, and you're saying the benefit as well. The other mistake I think people make is if they do save, they're so afraid of the stock market that they put it into fixed income investments like CDs, which barely, if at all, keep pace with inflation. And they feel safe, but they're really not safe considering the higher cost of maintaining oneself as they age. They will not have accumulated enough money. Let's go to the next step down. So we mentioned independent living. What is the next category?
We have assisted living. We have smaller apartments and trained aides and nurses to care for a person who perhaps is not able to care for themselves.
Yeah. What is the differential? And I don't need dollars. Is independent living more expensive or less expensive than the assisted care?
Less expensive than assisted care.
So independent living is cheaper than going into assisted
yeah.
care. Okay. All right. And those are facilities. I mean, maybe you have one room with a small kitchen that kind of doesn't really function. You can't really cook in it.
There's no kitchen,
in the
assisted living apartments.
Yeah, yeah.
Just one room.
Right. One room, a bathroom, some closets, and
yeah.
that's it.
Yeah.
Okay. But you have full nursing care, and it's good you know, if you can't get around and you need assistance or you have a fall or something like that, there's someone there to take care of you.
Absolutely. That's the reason for the assisted living section.
Okay.
One of the great problems of seniors is falling.
Yes. What about the next level down? So we have the independent care, we have the assisted living. What's next? What's the other choice?
Well, the skilled nursing facility, someone who's maybe bedridden and needs 24-hour-a-day care, and after that is memory care or Alzheimer's care.
Yeah. Well, these would be in addition to, if you're already in assisted living, you would go to these on a weekly basis or something like that. You're not actually living in those places, are you?
No. People are living our memory care and Alzheimer's care units.
Okay. And relatively speaking, is that the most expensive? Where does that kind of fit in?
Yes, that would be most expensive.
So let's talk about how one pays for this. Now, I know there are four primary sources of funding. There's the private pay. You have the money, you pay it yourself. Medicare will assist to some degree. There's long-term care insurance, which has its own positives and negatives. And then, of course, Medicaid.
Yes.
So I think private pay basically explains itself. You have enough money, you pay out of pocket. You've accumulated, you know, excess money of hundreds of thousands of dollars, and this will take you forward until the end of your days. How does Medicare fit into this?
Well, Medicare is not one of the things that I wanted to get into. I wanted to speak about Medicaid, which is...
Sure, let's do that. That's fine.
Which is a great benefit. However, you cannot attain Medicaid unless you have less than $2,000in assets.
Right.
And that has to be for a period of 5 years before you can even look for Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
So that leads to an elder care attorney who needs to prepare legal papers for you. Their charges run very high also. I have my notes here. Assisted living facilities run anywhere from $25 to $100 to $5,000 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And nursing home costs run anywhere from $7,500 to $11,000 and more.
Yeah.
And it is no wonder seniors in their 80s and 90s are challenged by how to pay for the cost of long-term care.
From your point of view, from your perch, how do you view the quality of care in Medicaid?
In Medicaid?
Yeah, if you have to go to a Medicaid facility.
That's the most serious problem, and we are not there yet.
Right. But as far as you can tell, I mean, you talk to people and you interview people that help you to write this article and give you information. Is the quality of Medicaid facilities, what's your general view? Good, bad, indifferent?
I think it's care that is special because people who are on Medicaid, many of them are in mental and physical distress.
I see.
And so the care that people are given at my facility is excellent.
Oh, that's good to hear. You know, unfortunately, Mort, we are out of time. My guest, Mort Mazur, writing articles for the Sun Sentinel on this very, very issue. So how often do they publish your articles, Mort?
About twice a month.
Okay, very good. And you, sir, you sound like you're doing fine. You're pretty healthy.
Yeah, I'm very fortunate.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
My wife is a little bit invalided, but we're coping and we will continue to cope.
Well, I'll tell you, Mort, you sound great to me, clear of mind, 95-year-old gentleman, and I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show with me today. Thank you.
Okay, Steve. Thank you.
Thank you. To hear this and any other interview that we do, or if you have a question about what we've just discussed, please visit our website, stevepomerantz.com. That's P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z, stevepomerantz.com, to join the conversation. While you're there, sign up for our weekly update. You'll hear all of these interviews that we do, plus my commentaries, and you can share with your friends as well. And don't forget also that we podcast. We've been podcasting for years. So go to your favorite podcast app and put in the name and you'll see us. You can hear us at your leisure on a time most convenient for you. That's stevepomerantz.com. A recession is inevitable. We know that, especially now with tariffs, the trade war, and the possibility of a looming war in the Middle East. So do you wonder how it will affect your financial security when it eventually comes? This is exactly what I'll be speaking to you about at my next workshop. I'll show you how to calculate whether you'll be financially secure for the rest of your life and how to make the right decisions to get financially secure and stay there. We'll talk about where to get the income you need, especially in this low interest rate world, and I'll also talk about how to get an early read on the next recession and ways to make sure your portfolio is properly positioned. These are just a few of the topics I'll be discussing, and of course, as always, I'm there to answer any of your questions. So, join me Tuesday, October 15th at 10 a.m. at the Boca Raton Renaissance Hotel. That's Tuesday, October 15th at the Boca Raton Renaissance Hotel. Go to stevepomerantz.com to sign up. That's stevepomerantz.com. I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Melzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.